what they ask.
Good morning, everyone.
Feel confident.
It is Monday, February 28th, and we're beginning our subcommittee on House and Joint House Senate Ways and Means Human Services, and we welcome Gary Weeks. Before we start, let's see if Sheila Baker has any information for us on this week.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, the next couple days will be department-wide support services of the Department of Human Services. This is the last budget cluster that you'll be hearing in these Phase 1 hearings for Department of Human Services. And the material that was handed out to you last week at your offices, and I am hopeful that it got into your binders. It would be under the last yellow tab, so way back at the back of the book. They have some overview material, some discussion about performance measures that the agency will present.
Okay. Director Weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. We're here to talk with you about department-wide services, support services. Everything that you need will be behind your last yellow tab at the very back of the book. We'll be working from back there. I guess you can notice by the absence of advocacy organizations and everything that this is a subject that's probably more important to us than it is to people that work with us day in and day out, but it is nonetheless a very important part of the department. It's what enables us to function, all of the department-wide services. Let me go back to remind you a little bit of the first day that we opened, and I talked with you a bit about all the work that's been done since the mid-90s to develop a real shared services model in DHS, because most of what you will hear about today around accounting and payroll and personnel and IT and so on like that was all part of each division in 1995. So there was a full complement of all administrative services within each of six divisions in 1995. And we spent most of the mid to late 90s and even into 2001 bringing that all together into what we call the shared services model of department-wide services. That was no easy challenge because, as you can well imagine, agency personnel who ran their own divisions were reluctant to give up many of the services that they had individually had and felt necessary to run their own divisions. But it was done. It was done well to the credit of people that you'll see in front of you over the next couple of days. And we think we have a support services model, department-wide support services model, that is very similar to what most large private organizations our size would try to run. Having said that, let me just talk a little bit about the director's office itself. It's obviously where I believe the vision for the agency and the values of the agency and the long-term planning for the agency have to originate. If the director's office doesn't have the ability to lead in those areas, you're going to have a department that's not only fragmented but unable to do a lot of the things that either you or the governor would want to have this department do. So the director's office spends a lot of time coordinating the work of the agency as a whole, working with the legislature, advocacy organizations, the tribes, service providers, because we depend so much on local service providers to get our work done. In thinking about the tribes, tribal relations is a very important part of what we do. For many years, the department had one real focus on the tribes, and that was through the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA. Indian Child Welfare governs how Native children come into our child welfare system. Foster care, adoptions, other kinds of permanent placements, and so on, are all under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And so we largely related to the tribes in that way for many, many years. And then when the TANF program came all around and tribal governments had the opportunities to actually engage in the TANF program on their own if they chose to, it began to change the way we related to the tribes. Similarly, as we worked more in community-based mental health services and addiction services, we also had different kinds of relationships with the tribes. And these are fairly complex relationships because the tribes, as sovereign governments, feel strongly about their own rights and privileges and their own special relationship to state government and local government. So we spend a lot of time on that relationship. In the 1999, I believe it was, I created a position within the department to manage the relationships with all the tribes. So in other words, rather than just try to treat this relationship as a child welfare relationship, it's much bigger, much broader than that. And I hired an individual who had worked with the tribes for a long time, Rick Azevedo, and we created within the director's office the Office of Tribal Relationships. My goal is to, during my first 6 years here and today, is to meet at least once a year with tribal councils. I go to their place, to the tribal council meeting places, and sit down with tribal councils, and we talk about what the issues are. And then each quarter we meet with the tribal governments as well, all together. Those meetings are for the purpose of talking about mental health services, children, child welfare services, addiction services. We have people from Housing and Community Services join us at that meeting as well. We have people from the Department of Consumer and Business Services join us. So it's a pretty significant regular meeting with the tribes. And they all, the nine recognized, federally recognized tribes, always send members. But I guess the point of all this is to tell you that we work very hard to try to maintain a good, close relationship with tribal governments in this state. We do a lot of business with them, and we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that that relationship is a good one, it's a strong one, and that tribal children and tribal elders who are under tribal programs, but programs similar to ours, are treated fairly and well through all of the human services areas. I want to, if there are no questions, I'm going to move to the auditing and consulting. Ms. Chairman, I'll just have you interrupt me and proceed until you do.
Continue.
Let me talk a little bit about the audit and consulting services. In the late 80s and early 90s, when I served as a deputy of this department, the department, your largest agency in government, had one internal auditor. One internal auditor. There was no audit plan or risk plan for the department at all. When I came back to the department as the director in 1995, one of the early things that I wanted to do was to create a true audit and consulting group, particularly an internal audit group. I mean, I feel very strongly about the importance of internal audits for agencies. They are for the purpose of identifying risk and then trying to develop plans to mitigate risk within the agency. So we now have an audit and consulting group that has two different kinds of functions. One is all the Medicaid provider audits, and we have five people that work as Medicaid auditors. In 2004, those five individuals recovered $1.7 million amongst the five of them. And that, if you work your math out, is about $340,000 per auditor in terms of recoveries. So they more than pay for the cost of their positions. And the kinds of things that they do is to go out and look at providers on incorrect billings, whether or not medications, particularly pharmaceuticals, were provided by providers without real authorization from the physician. They look at expenditures for durable medical goods and whether those all have all the appropriate backup and documentation around them. They look for misrepresentations in the client's condition. In other words, were we billed for services for a client where there's no evidence that the client really needed those kinds of services. So they are continually reviewing the Medicaid records for providers. Now, in addition, they do a lot of education services. So they work with providers in terms of trying to help providers understand the billing system, what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. So there's a great deal of education that we try to grow through. We work with providers on administrative rules, clarification of rules, amendments of rules, and so on that may make the program work more smoothly from a provider's position. So,
questions, Director. Now, does this also include hospitals in?
Yeah, all providers. We review provider services through the Medicaid audits, right?
Because I was in an interim committee meeting for government oversight, and there was a representative of a private auditing company who came in and testified, I think she's from Washington, as to the types of overbillings that take place. And she said that they have found that upwards of 90% of the billings from primarily hospitals have charge errors in them. And that the recovery that they had was really quite quite large. You're describing five auditors who, fortunately, are bringing in more than it costs, but not much more. And I'm wondering if there has been any utilization of private auditing companies to review providers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, let's remember that each of these hospitals does have their own audit services and everything. They have also their own internal audit services. So the hospitals themselves are doing some self-policing. We audit with, we just have these five folks, and doesn't the budget include additional ones for us? Or is that in the recovery side?
Both.
We've put into this budget additional auditors to increase this. Now, the $1.7 million, Mr. Chairman, is far above what it costs for five auditors. So they're recovering not just what they make, but considerably more. Now, the question is, could we recover even more if we put more staff on? I mean, that theoretically, that's possible. That's why we came to you with a request in this budget, which the governor has approved in this budget, to add some positions to try to recover more. But our goal here is to try to make sure that the provider is not misspending public monies, but it's also to try to work with the providers to ensure that they understand the rules that they can bill under, the services that they can bill for, and they do that appropriately and correctly. Because if that were true, we would have much less to recover. So we're trying to approach this in a couple of different ways, and
these are professionals, and so I understand that you like to help the hospitals and doctors know how to do it, but that's, you know, their interests are not the same as our interests necessarily. My question is, has your group of internal auditors and consultants, have you looked at the feasibility, whatever you called your group? You said that 15 years ago you had one auditor, and now you have a group, and I don't exactly know the term you used, but it was like an internal audit group or whatever. Have you looked at the feasibility and advisability of using outside auditing companies to do the audits for you, based on a cost plus or on a percentage of recovery or that kind of approach?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether, yeah. Do we need Cindy to do this?
Well, I can.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cindy Becker, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services. We are doing a couple of different things around this area. One is we have a request for proposal out for a private company to help us in the area of cost recovery. The reality is we can't do it all ourselves, and so the RFP for cost recovery is essentially a commission based, if you will. So if mm-hmm. if the private company collects, they get a commission off of that, and if they don't collect anything, then they don't get paid anything. So there's no cost to us.
That's specifically what I meant.
Right, and the RFP is in the process of we have all the we have four responses and we have four responses, and those will be done in the next few weeks.
Evaluating. That's exactly what I was hoping that you would be saying,
right.
That we are looking at that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to introduce Cindy Scheich, who is the director of our internal audits and consulting program. And I don't know if you have specific questions. I think Cindy can help us on this too. So,
yeah, for the record, I'm Cynthia Scheich, and I am the chief audit officer with the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Chairman, to answer your question about hospitals, we are specifically dwelling into that area. It is a very complex area to audit. The hospital billings happen in a way different way than a standard fee-for-service, what we call fee-for-service. That's much more straightforward, that they bill a specific code, an office visit, per se. So they bill us for an office visit. We get the record from the doctor. They saw the person. It fits into this code. It's a little more straightforward. The hospitals, and I don't honestly understand it all. I'm not one of the people that gets into the daily workings of auditing it. But they bill us under what's called DRGs. So it's much, you have to dig several levels. It's not a straightforward bill. It's very, a lot of things get grouped together under, I think, what's called the DRG, and then it funnels through to us, and we pay a certain amount per each thing. So it's complex, but we do have auditors who are working on it right now. It certainly an interesting thing that we could look for, consultants who do specialist type auditing, possibly some that do specific audits of hospitals. So that's something we can certainly take under advisement to do in the future. But it is something that we're doing right now.
Okay, now the auditors, or the RFPs that Cindy was referring to, that would not include hospitals? Is that what when it is?
No, it would. Yes, Mr. Chairman, it would include hospitals. It's looking for specific, any type of duplicate billings. So it's taking our data and it's going to look for anything that looks like a duplicate, be it from a hospital, from a physician, from a pharmacy, all range of providers.
A second ago you said we'll take it under advisement, and a couple minutes ago Cindy says we got four people that are bidding on this and we're looking at it right now, and so it's happening or not happening.
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of things going on. One is that we have a certain capacity within the department to do this function. And with the staff we have, we are, as Cindy was saying, we are going ahead with that. But there's more capacity, there's more out there than we have the capacity to go after. So to supplement our efforts, we're doing this RFP so a private sector company can go in and also go after cost recovery for duplicate billings. So it's not an either or, it really is complementing the work that we do.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions on the audit aspect? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are some examples of the types of internal audits that you've done other than the Medicare billing?
Representative Chairman and Representative Hansen, the examples of some audits we've done, we actually brought some with us. We've done various types of audits that usually are driven by a risk assessment that we complete with the department. And some examples, one thing that we focused on in 2004 was looking at what we call discretionary payments. Those were all across the department, things where a caseworker has a lot of discretion on things they can pay for, be it a utility bill, a client's rent, other assistance that helps keep them either in their home setting or helps them with jobs and that sort of activity. So we did, we did a focused audit for the self-sufficiency area. It was called our special cash pay system. And so we looked at discretionary payments in that area. That was specifically some services provided by our seniors and people with disability cluster, and also by our children, adults, and families cluster. So we did that audit early in 2004. We called that phase one. We then did a phase two audit where we looked at our vocational rehabilitation area, the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and we focused our audit there on same types of things, things that aren't necessarily outlined specific in rule, where the caseworker has a little more discretion to get that for the client because that assists the client in their plan for self-sufficiency or becoming ready for jobs and that sort of activity. We are currently right now in the third phase of that, and this audit is ongoing, and that's looking at our child welfare area. So we're looking at some system of care funds, flex funds, and one-time payment funds out of the child welfare area. So that we figure that's kind of our third phase of looking at those type of payments. So that was one activity that we felt was warranted looking at department-wide, but given the scope of it, we had to break it down into three audits. That's one example. Another example we looked at was looking at our DHS contracting, and we did that as a follow-up. Some of you may recall the Secretary of State did a pretty big audit on DHS and our contracting practices. So we took this as some time had gone by, and we decided to take a look to see, have we changed our practices? Have we addressed those things that the Secretary of State recommended that we do to improve our contracting? So we wanted to do that as a follow-up because we felt that was a high activity of the department and we needed to ensure that we were doing those things appropriately and per rule.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we also try to keep some flexibility in the internal audit group so that if I, as the director, say we need some attention to something, we can do that, and that happened earlier this year in Douglas County. We had a provider that, an alcohol and drug treatment provider that working with the court, there was a lot of, in the county, there was a lot of feeling that the money hadn't been well spent, that all the resources weren't accounted for. The court felt like there were some resources unaccounted for. It was a very difficult situation, and I made a decision to send an internal audit team down there to work with both the court and the provider, and we did. Cindy's team did a very thorough audit down there. We identified what was real and what was suspected, and I think we got a pretty good outcome out of that for county government. So I try to make sure that she has some time to do those kinds of things. But the decisions about what we look at through internal audits are made after we review all of our activities. So Cindy brings us a long list of, you know, what kind of risks appear to be out there in the department, and some of those similar to what she's described. It's far larger than what we have staff to do, the list usually is. And so we sit around in our cabinet and we make decisions about where the risk is the greatest. Cindy and her staff only report to the director. They have no other reporting assignment. That's to give her and her people maximum independence to look into anything and not have anyone get in the way within the department. So once we've reviewed all the risks and we know how many audit hours we have, we make choices about where the highest risk is and how we best use the internal audit team. And that's an annual thing. There's an annual internal audit program. Actually, it's biannual, I guess. We do it over a couple of years. And then we have to modify it, of course, as things come up. But the point is we are very thoughtful about how we look at where the greatest risks are in this department. And then Cindy and her staff work closely with the Secretary of State. This is one of the great, in my view, advantages to having a good internal audit program is you can do a lot of the work that precedes the Secretary of State's work, which means that there are papers ready, there are backgrounds ready, there's stuff ready for the Secretary of State's office to come in, and it reduces our cost as an agency if we've got a real effective internal audit program going and a close relationship with the Secretary of State, and that's worked for several years for us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also, it's important to know that the internal audit is really a tool for the agency. And oftentimes we have an internal audit committee that meets every couple of months. And we also have actually a professor from Willamette sit on that committee. And what we also talk about are lessons learned. So when the audit team goes in, it's what did we learn from that audit? Because typically a practice is not solely limited to an individual activity. And so we look at the lessons learned there and can those be applied to other similar activities across the department. We also look for best practices. So if an audit identifies a best practice in a certain area, again, can we use that and look at that across the department? And we're looking, when we do the risk assessment, at three areas: the risk in terms of dollars, the risk in terms of people, and the risk, quite frankly, in terms of public perception. And you probably ask, give me an example of the public perception one, and probably the best one we can give is the medical marijuana program. A couple of years ago when there were some concerns in that program that there was some forged signatures, and we did an audit of the program. There were a couple of forged signatures, but the larger issue was there was one physician who had given out 800 prescriptions. And we went in and did really an overhaul of that entire program. There was no mis-expenditure of dollars, but again, it was a public perception issue, and the physician, I think, eventually got, what's the physician word for disbarred? Whatever that was, that's what happened. But so we go in terms of public perception issues and not just the big-ticket financial issues.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris Anderson.
A lot of our expense health care costs are in the Medicare population. And do you do audits on, you know, hospice visits or those types of agencies? The home visiting.
Yeah, agency. Mr. Chairman, Senator Moses Anderson, you're speaking about the Medicaid program, right? Not the Medicare. You said Medicare, but well, we actually don't. You don't audit any Medicare programs because
a lot of people who are on hospice are reimbursed from Medicare and not Medicaid. So you wouldn't even touch that.
No, because as the federal audit process will audit on the Medicare side of the house. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Just for clarification, in the audit department, you have your two divisions. You said there's five in the Medicaid auditing. How many auditors do you have in the internal audit?
Mr. Chairman, I have six internal auditors right now that do internal focus strictly on internal audit work.
And are all of the positions that you have available filled?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they are right now all filled.
Okay, thanks.
It's not always the case, but right now they are.
Representative Hansen.
You can be here. Do you have capacity for performance audit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, I guess, I mean, some of the audits we undertake do sort of equate to a performance audit. If you hear, you know, the Secretary of State sort of puts their audits into two categories, a performance audit and a financial audit. Pretty much all of our audits are in the performance area. We're looking at the effectiveness, efficiency of a program. Sometimes we're looking at the compliance of a program. We do a lot less activity in what would be termed a strict financial audit, like the Secretary of State would do. So most of our audits fall into the category of a performance-type audit.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman, we're going to move on to the Governor's Advocacy Office and have Cindy walk you through that. But actually, before she starts, let me say one other thing that's not listed in here. I mentioned this when we opened. We have a pretty significant volunteer program, and I worry that we frequently don't get enough information out about that. But we have nearly 1,800 volunteers that are working with our offices and community groups all across the state. They do over 450,000 hours of volunteer time a year. That's all coordinated through the department, and those kinds of activities are drivers, driver escorts, mentors, literacy tutors for both adults and children. We provide child care services when clients need some child care in order to get treatment or in order to get services. We have a program called Lunch Buddies that puts retired persons largely into the schools to work with kids at the noon hour. So there's a lot of volunteerism that's going on that I'm afraid we don't highlight frequently enough. And these people do a tremendous job of providing services in their communities throughout the state. So, Cindy, you want to start
on
with you?
Thank you. Actually, before I start on GAO, I wanted to talk about one other thing that's a follow-up to what Cindy was talking about, internal audit. It goes to what the chair talked about in terms of recovery. One of the things that Gary mentioned earlier was looking at shared services, what we did several years ago, started that process where we brought like functions together in the administrative arena. And one of the areas that since Gary and I have been back, one of the areas that we're also looking at is the whole area of payment accuracy and recovery. We have pockets of that throughout the department where children, adults, and families, folks in the in OMAP, in Cindy's unit, and also in seniors and people with disabilities are either investigating fraud or dealing with recoveries in some other investigation, are looking at payment accuracy, are doing audits, and they are interspersed throughout the agency. And we think, in addition to what we found in efficiencies when we put all the rest of administrative services together, we're gathering up those functions across the department, and we'll put them together as an Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery for the agency. So there'll be a central place, for example, if someone is reporting fraud. There'll be a central place for identification of overpayments. The other piece of that is, and you're going to hear about it tomorrow from Bill Krall on the Medicaid Management Information System, the key to recovery is not to have recovery, but is to identify any of those overpayment audits and edits in systems before you make the payment. So you want to have your checks and balances within your technology so that those monies don't go out the door. Once they go out the door, though, you want to have a really good recovery system. Those two should work together. And so part of the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery will be working with the programs and working with the technology to make sure if we're seeing things over and over again, the same thing, so we've got a problem somewhere where we're sending out overpayments, we can put a fix in the system and audit and edit up front so those types of payments don't happen. We'll also have the DS-CERS, which is Decision Support utilization surveillance system, that's a technology that will help us identify where those outliers are, so that that's driven from the system. So when we get payment profiles and we see outliers, so certain type of physician, I think you mentioned it earlier, Chair, about Bend, how it's such a high number of surgeries are happening in Bend. It may or may not mean that something's wrong, but it gives us the heads up to go out and look. So we're going to be using our technology to help drive some of our work in that area rather than just waiting for a tip from somebody.
That's excellent. And we have the capacity to do that. And with 50 states all dealing with Medicaid, it seems like we wouldn't have to be writing that from scratch, that there would be a way to determine by technology if there's a need for two surgeries in the same procedure. And it'd be very complicated, but it would seems like it would be able to determine that. Of course, the counterbalance is to all the data that has to be input. And of course, if they're billing electronically, then you're in a much better position. Okay. I'm glad we're making progress in that area. Senator Winters.
Two questions. One, how do we compare with other states on recovery? For fraud and payment, and also I don't know if you have a copy, but I know that there was a story in Budget and Taxes, which is the Heartland paper, and where Oregon, excuse me, there were five states that were mentioned. Oregon was one of them, and the good news is that it was on the positive side of the ledger as to states that had a concerted effort and a good outcome at recovering of Medicaid, either overpayments or fraud. And I'd like to know if you have further in-depth of where we are over the overall 50 states.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we'll get that information for you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, related to this, we've had several different companies come to us, Maximus, for example, which is one of the largest recovery companies in the state, in the country, come to us and want to do business privately. In fact, I had Maximus here for 6 weeks on a pro bono thing several years ago, and their conclusion was that there isn't enough recovery for them to really make money. They need to go into states that are doing a very poor job of either maximizing their federal revenue or losing a lot of recoveries. And it's not the test that you're looking for, Senator Winters, but I think this is some evidence that we're doing a pretty good job when we've got these large companies who say there's not enough here for us to make a lot of money on. And so
actually, where I'm going with this is that if we're doing somewhat of a good job, and if we can build on that which we're doing, rather than, you know, often we sit up here and we ask you to scrap systems, and those systems may be working for us, maybe not to the level. And so I'd like to look at what we're doing and what can be done to enhance what we're doing, because if this particular article is accurate, we were in the top five.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator says we'll get that information for you. I think one of the issues for us, and really was one of the drivers for putting this Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery together, is we saw what was going on in some other states that were consolidating. I think North Carolina is usually the model that's used. And
I believe they were among the groups. So I'm asking you to look at really this in-depth study that was done of the various states. And and like I said, we were among the top five. The other question that was raised was private versus public, and Oregon was looked at having a lot of private partnerships, where some other states was almost totally public. So you may want to look at this article and look at some of the questions that were raised and asked.
Right. Senator, could you give the name of the article again?
It was a Budget and Taxes.
And it was in where?
It's the Heartland News, one of the Heartland publications. I think I have it upstairs, and I'll make sure that my staff get you.
That'd be great.
They devoted about three pages to this subject on Medicaid recovery.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we try to recover on TANF for food stamps or something, either an overpayment or a fraud, we deduct, usually isn't the recovery made by reducing benefits and taking mistaken for benefits in the future rather than actually like seizing an asset or something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's right. When it comes to individual collections from clients, most of it is cost avoidance. We do try to get some dollars in overpayment, you know, whether it's to collect past money, but, you know, clients who are getting the services usually don't have a lot of money, mm-hmm. so it's usually in a cost avoidance in future costs.
Okay. Is there a guideline in terms of what percentage you can reduce benefits in order to recover?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we'll have to get that information for you.
Yeah. The other issue that comes to mind is in a different setting, different committee, we're looking at an incredible problem in terms of collection of restitution and fines from. And I'm wondering if your system would be, if there's a potential to help us on recovery there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we can certainly talk about that. As Director Week said, we can barely keep up with the workload we have. One other thing I do want to mention is our involvement with PARIS, which is Public Assistance Reporting Information System. And this is a system that's run out of Washington, D.C. through the Administration on Children and Families. And it's a voluntary system. It's free to the states. We just joined it last year. And what it does is it runs extracts from Medicaid, TANF, and food stamp, extracts from files, and runs them against three different files. One is other states' files. There's 28 states involved with PARIS right now. And what it does is look at potential duplicates. So any state that's involved with PARIS, when they submit their data, the data is all run against each other, if you will. And so if there are individuals receiving duplicate payments from two or more states, PARIS file will flag that. Obviously, one of the biggest states that we have duplicates with is Washington. And so we just did that run in November. We're looking at that. The two other files that the PARIS runs against, one is Veterans files and one is Department of Defense federal files. And that's to look to see whether or not individuals who are receiving any of our benefits are also receiving either Veterans benefits or other federal pension benefits, and to make sure that they are declaring those benefits that they are receiving. It doesn't make them get those benefits, but if they are getting them, we want to make sure that that information is available to us. And so those files were also run in November, and we're trying to sort through all of that and meeting with Veterans Affairs to make sure we understand all the codes, but we think that would be another source for recovery.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hansen, or Representative Hansen, getting back to your first question, I think one of the things we could do is look at the strategies that we use and compare those with the strategies that are being used to collect fines, liens, and that sorts of things, because there may be some protocols and strategies that we use that they could adopt to improve their own collections. So, and we're happy to sit down and do that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Now, if I can go to the governor's advocacy office, and you know, two of your members know more about this office than I certainly do. Senator Winters and Senator Montes Anderson, you're now on the Pain Management Committee, I understand? Commission, excuse me. And I also have, we also have Naomi Steenson here, who is the manager for that office. So I'm just going to go over some information about it. And if you have questions, please feel free to ask me or Senator Winters. The Governor's Advocacy Ombudsman Office was established in the department in July of 1993. We have eight individuals on staff. In addition to the administrator, we have one individual who focuses on alternate formats and ADA, American with Disabilities Act, to make sure that we comply with that. We have a child welfare ombudsman. We also have a pain management coordinator and four individuals, what we call generalist ombudsmen. These individuals are also bilingual. Spanish, Russian, Portuguese, and Vietnamese languages are spoken. The role of the Children's Ombudsman was added to the department actually officially in 2003, although in November 1996 we did have a relationship with the Commission on Children and Families for this service. just to give you an example, the pain management program was also created by the legislature in 1999. Senate Bill 885, approved by the 2001 legislature, created the Pain Management Commission. And the purpose of the Pain Management Commission is really one of education, and educational standards of licensed and certified health providers, and to promote awareness of chronic pain patients' treatment needs. So it really is an education for individuals in the medical field, looking at the high cost of health care, looking at how educating physicians and other licensed individuals on how individuals with chronic pain can best be treated. Just to go back a little bit with the ombudsman, they receive about 100 to 200 phone calls every day, 120 to 150 emails a day, 10 to 15 letters a day. They are very, very busy. I'm just going to go over some of the typical types of questions that they get. As you would expect, they get questions and complaints, people who are unhappy, for example, with child welfare. You wouldn't expect individuals whose children were removed to be happy. And sometimes people are unhappy because the children were taken away too early. Sometimes they're unhappy because the children weren't taken away early enough. We also do have reports of abuse and neglect regarding both children and adults, seniors and people with disabilities. There are complaints if people feel they were denied a service inappropriately or denied a benefit inappropriately. Also, individuals in crisis, the phone lines were certainly overloaded when we had all the changes with the Oregon Health Plan Plus and clearly with the Oregon Health Plan Standard. Lots of individuals calling, asking for where they can go for assistance. Calls people who are ill or recently disabled, and they're looking how do they get their Social Security benefits. Also calls people who need services, people with disabilities and seniors who need services, parents of medically fragile children looking to where they can go for services. Also, we have lots of inquiries about vital records and health licensing and various places to go to get services or to get classes for licensing. I'd like to say there's nothing that they haven't seen or heard, although probably tomorrow there will be something that comes across the lines. But this is an incredibly dedicated staff who probably know more about the agency or more how to get information about the agency than anyone else. They have access to records so that they can help individuals kind of maneuver through the agency. They have access, obviously, to all the staff in the agency. They also report directly to the director's office if there are complaints about employees, if there are complaints about services. They can easily come to us directly and have those conversations. They are, at one point, I think, were they in the governor's office?
Yes.
They were in the governor's office. It's probably why they're called governor's advocacy office. And they also work directly with the governor's office. And I think there's some other advocates and other agencies like corrections, and they also work together. But they really are our connection, the most direct connection we have to all Oregonians who have any questions or issues or concerns or compliments about the department.
Mr. Chair, ideally, and I'm not proliferating all these ombudsmans all over the place because I don't believe that, and I really wanted to bring ombudsmans back in one central location, back in the governor's office where it has access to the governor so that you're actually dealing with these complaints at a much higher level. But having said that, and since we couldn't get there, this was an alternative. A part of the outcome that I didn't hear, that I'd like to hear, is that is where you find clusters and problems to be able for that office to come up with recommendation so that you're not dealing with the same issues year after year after year or session after session. And so that kind of reporting that is brought forth, whether it is by requiring administrative changes or whether it's requiring statutory changes. Because the ombudsman, by its very nature, does more than just provide informational access or telling people where they should or should not go or how to access the system. But ideally, they should be talking about what you can do to take corrective action so that it's not continually repeated. And then I've got to put a plug in for them because they were absolutely incredible during our crisis when we had the issue of the Measure 28 and those where you had people that had severe needs. And they provided not only where to go, but I know assisted a lot of individuals in order to find resources. So I'll put that plug in for them. But I still think, and I don't know if they've done that or if you've got a report when they come forward that says what their recommended changes are, because it's more than just talking about, the number of complaints that come into the office.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you're absolutely correct. And they do a monthly report to the cabinet that talks about these are the types of issues that are coming forward to us. And the cabinet will talk about those as well as here are the types of things that are happening and what can be done about them. So it's not just individual phone calls, but what are the trends, what are the types of things they're hearing, and where do we go from there?
Then it would be helpful if you could provide this, you know, and some information as to what changes have occurred as a result of ombudsman activity.
Okay.
Because that's an outcome, a positive performance outcome that says, you know, this is what we learned, this is how we've improved the system in order to make the system work better for the citizens of the country.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, we can do that because their work leads us to examine administrative rules, leads us to think about how we propose the budget to you, leads us to think about statutory changes that may be necessary, and it's probably the service that legislators, individual legislators, utilize most within the department is the advocacy office. And I want to echo Cindy's comments. They do a terrific job. This is not a fun job in many occasions. Naomi can correct me if I'm wrong, but they're on the phone all day long with people that have significant problems that need some resolution. And they are the ones that have to try to figure out where in the department do we go to resolve these problems. And over 95% of the time, and we keep track of all this, you know, they're able to find some resolution for these clients. So it's a very beneficial service. And having the children's ombudsman brought in there has just made it more complete. It was an awkward relationship, as Cindy says, because originally the Commission on Children and Families was, as Senator Winters remembers well, was charged with the children's ombudsman. And they had an 800 number and so on. None of that was ever actually put into place, because they didn't have the resources to do it. And so we struck an interagency agreement where we said we'll fold it into our office and we will provide the 800 number and so on. And eventually the legislature made that a permanent solution to the Children's Ombudsman, and that's how it moved forward. So.
If I may move forward now to the newest function that's part of the director's office, and that is the Process Improvement Office. Clearly, over the past several biennia, with the increasing caseloads, the increase in demand on services, and either the leveling off or decreasing availability of resources, there's no way that we can continue on this course without imploding. And so one of the things that we're taking a serious look at and we're devoting some resources to is process improvement. You have increased demand, you have decreased resources, we need to start looking at how we do our business. Are there some ways to streamline what we do? Are there ways to standardize the way that we do our business? Department of Human Services is nothing if it's not process. We have a process for processes. We have a process for everything. And over the years, what has happened is those processes have become more complicated. We've had processes that have layered things on top of each other, and nothing has been taken away. And we have extremely manual processes. And so one of the things that we're taking an active interest and focus in is, can we start peeling away the onion, asking people, why are you doing all these different steps? If you ask them, they'll either say, well, the feds make us do it, the state makes us do it, or more than 50% of the time, because this is how the last person in the job did it. It doesn't mean it's wrong, it's just this is the way we've always done it. And so what we're looking at now is every step in we're identifying some key processes and looking at the steps involved to make sure that all those steps are value added. How many people have to touch a piece of paper before it gets out of the door? More importantly, do we have to generate a piece of paper to get a process in place? And we believe we've seen the data from other places in the private and public sector. We've also have some examples already in our agency where we can save time and money, and we can redevote the program staff's time to program and less on administration through process improvement. And I would just like to give you a couple of examples. In the Oregon Health Plan Processing Center, the issue was application time was enormous. Processing those applications was enormous. We went through what's called an RPI, a rapid process improvement workshop. And what they do oftentimes in process improvement is you map the process. You start at the beginning of the process and you map out every single step. And what happens when you're doing that is typically people involved in that will go, God, I didn't know you did that, or do you do that too? And you see that there's built-in inefficiencies because those processes have happened over time. Anyway, as a result of this rapid improvement process, we were able to streamline the process down from 26 days to 3 days. What we looked at is rearranging the process, looking at the various steps in it, and looking at things that we could eliminate. We had a similar success in the food processing center, reducing the time it took, food stamp processing center, not food processing center. Again, we had an issue with how long it took to process those food stamp applications. As a result of process improvement, we reduced the time from 45 days to 12 days. And we had a similar success in other food stamp processing parts of the organization. One of the things that we're doing, for example, although it's not a big process improvement project, is we're automating the travel reimbursement claims. You can't believe how much paper we generate to claim going to a trip across the state. So what we have taken upon ourselves is to automate that process. So the employee has to keep their own backup documentation. But after that, it's for auditing purposes, but after that, you shouldn't have to generate the amount of paper and the amount of handoffs for individuals to claim reimbursement for their travel expenses. After all, as someone said, we know who they are and we know where they live. So if there's a problem, we can always recover that.
Mr. Chair,
Senator question. Warner.
I know you're going to get there. How many forms do you have in the department?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, we have several thousand forms in the department, and that's some of that's a result of various languages, but it's not most of it. We have a form for everything, and we are going to be looking at that.
As you look at that, are you also looking at a policy of ongoing purging forms and forms review. I know you have a forms and document management, but inside of that, do you routinely, from the field to the state office, do forms review, and how frequently do you do it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I'll be honest, we don't. We keep forms around. We, pay for storage for old forms. We do not have a process for that, and that's one of the things, as we go through this whole improvement, that we will be purging a lot of things.
Usually it's tied to the pride of authorship. Mm-hmm. I know it was when I was here, and I know that, in fact, it was Governor Straub who then required that all agencies went through forms review in order to get rid of, one, duplication, because it was very costly,
mm-hmm.
and number two, to purge that system, regardless of who authored it. And the other thing, it was done in order to streamline, because if you're going to go into processes, it also begins to streamline those functions. And I think we found during that period of time that there were probably more forms down in the field staff than there were in central office. And once you started purging some of those, you may have had a little more efficient system.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I think it's authorship, and as well as people's inability to do without one little piece of information. Well, the applications all line up for different programs, but there's one thing that is not on one application. And we've got to just move ourselves away from that and say, look, if we're collecting what we need to run the program and we can do it in one form rather than a dozen, we're going to do it in one form.
And just in summary, we're doing.
Representative Hanson.
I'm sorry.
On that line, when I had was operating a small business, I received an IRS packet of information, and there was a separate piece of paper in there that said, Ms. Packett conforms with the Paper Reduction Act of 1978 or whatever.
That's right.
You might also this one is another one of those issues that I think is costly.
Sure.
It's extremely costly. You know, you talk 1,000 forms that somehow are being used, and so I don't want to diminish the importance of doing forms review. The other thing is that I happened to be called to help a neighbor, and when I looked at the forms for the Oregon Health Plan, I just about went bonkers. I mean, you know, whether we write in clear and concise language so that people understand, because if you understand based on the instructions, then there isn't always the need for somebody technically over there to help us walk through it. And I had difficulty with it, so I thought, if I have difficulty with it, I wonder what's happening out there in the world for those who don't understand our language. And that's another piece of forms management.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we're also trying to, as much as possible, not for the clients, because it is different there, but certainly for our stakeholders and for interested parties and our staff. We have just implemented a system called eSubscribe, which is email subscription service. So you can go into our homepage and click eSubscribe, and then you can sign up electronically for any. There's a whole list of areas on our website if you want to receive information. So, and as we update that information, you would get an email that said, Senator Winters, we've updated the rules on XYZ, if you check that box off when you signed up. And then you would get an email, and then you would have you could click right onto that site. What that does for us is, first of all, gets us out of keeping all these listservs, which are usually out of date because somebody has changed their email. It also gets us out of mailing everything to people, so it reduces our paper and printing and postage costs. And it really is a self-service. It lets you decide what information on our website you want. And as we update it, you would get an email that says it's updated, and you can decide if you want to look at that. We've seen what's happened in other jurisdictions in terms of the savings, and it's increased customer service. You're only getting the information that you want to receive. We're reducing our paper costs. We're reducing staff time costs. So we think it really is a win-win for everybody. We're trying to move as much information as possible onto our website, use the technology that's available. Clearly, with our clients, we're always going to be, well, at least in the foreseeable future, having paper information go to them. It's a continual struggle to make sure we're at the right grade level in terms of to make sure the information is understandable and also in the appropriate languages. So it really is that balance. But we're trying to use technology in any way we can to make things more efficient.
Certainly that's important. In the private sector, it also results in a more efficient utilization of resources. I may have mentioned in law firms, when I started 25 years ago, it was over 2 support staff for every attorney, and now you have at least 2 attorneys for every process, you know, manager, and no longer secretaries, now they're data processors. And it's because the electronic capabilities have reduced the requirement on staff. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen, but maybe you can enlighten us as to a similar reduction in the requirement for staffing since you have such an increased ability under technology.
Mr. Chair, if we can get you the information on support staff, but if you look, I remember, you know, when I started 25 years ago, there were a lot more support staff around than there are today. So in terms of people, program people, professional staff, and managers doing their own work that you used to give to, you know, what was called the secretary, that just doesn't happen much anymore.
Right.
We can try. We'll get you that information.
I'd like to see it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Because looking at the customer that you're getting the message to and technology, and, of course, my thought immediately goes to how many seniors have computers, because this generation coming along is very technically savvy, but my generation struggles with computers. So I know Jacqueline's in the back, and so if you're sending communication to them, I wondered how many of them really do have access to computers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I don't know specifically. We know in things that we've read, Oregon is probably one of the most connected, internet-connected states in the country. How that breaks down by age group, I don't have that information.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm done with process improvement, and I think we're going to be turning this over to administrative services to Clyde.
Yeah, I want to come back to one thing that we may have not touched on, and that was the another part of the work of the Governor's Advocacy Office, and that has to do with the ADA and our compliance with that. I think we may have jumped over that, but that's such an important piece of what we do that I want you to understand that in the GAO office, the Governor's Advocacy Office, they are responsible for making sure that people with disabilities have access to programs, and access to programs is not physical access to buildings, but it's access to the information, and that means presenting information in things like large print, tapes, cassettes that are DVD or CD type, oral and sign language presentations throughout all the state whenever we do major meetings. And so our ability to communicate with people with disabilities and make them aware of programs and how they come into our system and how they work in our system is also a part of the Governor's Advocacy Office. And I'd be remiss if we moved on without making sure that we express that to you. So now if you're okay, we'll move on to the administrative services, and I'll ask Clyde Psyche, who is the Director of Administrative Services, to join us now.
Chairman Richardson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the department. And this morning, I'll be providing you with an overview of DHS Administrative Services. The overview starts on page 6 of your handout, and that's where you'll find our mission statement, which is to support DHS through timely, accurate, effective, and consistent administrative systems. To help us achieve our mission, we've established three primary goals. The first goal is implementing standardized business practices that are used throughout the department. Standardized business practices are key to the department being able to deliver efficient and effective business services. The second goal is to increase the efficiency, effectiveness, and coordination of administrative services through the consolidation of functions across the department. The consolidation of administrative services allows us to maximize our resources, better utilize staff, and reduce duplication. The third goal is the development of department-wide policies and procedures to guide administrative activities. Prior to our administrative consolidation, each part of the department had their own set of administrative policies and procedures. This was frustrating and confusing for staff, as well as vendors. By implementing department-wide policies, we've reduced the frustration and confusion for staff and the vendors that provide services to our department. The services provided by administrative services are part of the business infrastructure of our department. In many organizations, people don't really pay much attention to the infrastructure until something goes wrong. For example, you heard earlier that 80% of the DHS budget goes out to local communities through payments to contractors and clients. Our accounting, contracts, and information systems offices play key roles in making sure these payments happen. A breakdown or problem in any one of these areas could lead to delays in payments, which would then lead to financial issues for both clients and providers. On page 8, you'll find the overview for our Office of Financial Services. This office provides accounting, payroll, and recovery services for the department. Our payroll section is responsible for preparing and disbursing employee paychecks and for tracking leave time. They also assist staff with timesheet problems and answer questions on employee benefits. On pages 8 and 9, you'll see a summary of the services provided by the accounting section of financial services. This includes making payments to vendors, travel reimbursement, provider payments, reconciling financial statements, and receiving payments that are made to the department. Two other important functions in this part of financial services are the federal fiscal reporting and the management of the department's cost allocation plan. These two functions are a critical piece of the department's process of drawing down the federal funds we need to and use to run our programs. On pages 9 and 10, there's a summary of the financial recovery section. This section is responsible for collecting and recovering money through overpayments or fraud through clients and as well as vendors. The units in this section collect overpayments in areas such as Medicaid and food stamps, and you'll also see in the summary of the sections, there's also a summary of the amounts that each unit collected in the last fiscal year. Altogether, this unit was responsible for collecting over $99 million from both clients and providers. Our Office of Contracts and Procurement overview. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
That $99 million, what's the relationship between that and the audit, Medicaid audit division?
Mr. Chair, this is exactly what I was talking about a little earlier with putting together an Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. This is in addition to the dollars that you heard Cindy talk about collected through Medicaid audit. So, again, here we've got different – we actually have another part of our agency that is involved in this. And so we're going to be putting those all together. But this $99 million is in addition to the Medicaid audit recoveries.
Okay, just what's the coordination? Just if you could just explain that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's what Cindy's thinking right now. We think we have some people, Mr. Chairman, doing a pretty good job trying to recover, but we've got three different recovery operations, and we're going to put those all together under a single leadership and coordinate the recovery activities that are going on within the department.
Okay, thank you.
Should I continue?
Please continue.
Okay. On page 11, you'll find the overview for our Office of Contracts and Procurement. As I said earlier, approximately 80% of our budget goes out to local communities in the form of payments to vendors and clients. In a typical biennium, this unit writes and processes close to 10,000 contracts and contract amendments to assist with the disbursement of these funds. During the past two biennia, this office has implemented several initiatives that have increased the effectiveness and efficiency of the department's contracting processes. One of these has been the development of a department-wide template that is now used for all our contracts. These templates have led to less negotiating time and quicker processing time for contractors. We've also been working on consolidating purchasing within the department to leverage better price breaks for the department. An example of this is the initiative we recently completed on centralizing the management of our copiers. Through centralization, we've managed to both reduce the number of copiers we have as a department in total. We've also gotten more appropriate copiers with less cost for units, and then we've also reduced the copying charges in general within the department. On page 12, there's an overview for the Office of Public Affairs, and Cindy is going to provide this overview for the committee.
Mr. Chair, before we move there, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you also have the capacity to do contract compliance?
Chairman Richardson and Senator Winters, right at this moment, the contract administration is really handled by the program offices. The contracting office, the centralized contracting offices, is more responsible for making sure that the contracts are written, negotiated, and that they pass legal sufficiency. When it comes to our attention that there is a problem, we do look into contract compliance, but basically, outside of the program offices, the contract compliance function would typically fall to the internal audit office.
Also, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's been an issue. Contract administration has been an issue. And clearly that was noted in previous audits by the Secretary of State, where what Clyde's office does is they bring the contract from the idea form all the way to developing the contract. Once the contract is developed, there is a contract administrator named in that contract. It then goes over to the program responsible for administering it. And we have had some significant problems with contract administration. Although it's not to say it's any better or worse, but it's been a statewide issue in many agencies. We have developed some contract administration training that we're requiring all of our managers to participate in. We also have follow-up internal audits on this issue. We take it very seriously because of the amount of money that goes out through contracts. We know we've got some deficiencies, and we are trying to attend to those.
Are you looking at sometime in the future to maybe centralize that responsibility so it's independent enough to actually go out and do compliance? I just kind of want to know where you're headed.
Senator Winters, internal audits, they will go out and they will pull either by type of contract or by program area. They will pull the contracts to look at that. And that will happen over time, and also Secretary of State is looking at that as well. The issue really is people who are administering contracts are primarily program people, and they have this responsibility for administering a contract that is probably something, you know, that they had never been trained to do. So we think the training is going to really help so people understand what their responsibilities are around contract administration in terms of making sure that contractors comply with the contract, making sure you're not paying them more than the contract, making sure that you're paying them within the contract. And so that is something that's never happened before at the agency. We've just assumed that people knew what to do. So we think this education and awareness, and then followed up with the audits, is going to really solidify that system.
I guess I'm trying to visualize. Program people tend to be program people and not contract compliance individuals, even with training, because you really get caught up in the outcome of it and the nuances of program. But anyway.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, you're right. They're not compliance people, but they are the frontline folks who know when we're having a problem with the contract, because they know what's being billed and so on like that. And the real enforcement arm is the internal audit people. And as I mentioned to you, like the case we had in Douglas County, we have a very large audit going on of a medical provider in Portland that, you know, we're hopeful we'll work out some kinds of agreements, but there were some serious problems about what we were being billed for, the services we were billed for, and it was our program people that could see what was happening. But it's the internal audit folks who actually go in there and audit the record and make decisions about whether the contract was being followed precisely. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, the other piece of that is we are trying to provide information on an ongoing basis to contract administrators as to pending expiration dates of the contracts, where they are in terms of the amount not to exceed of the contract, and giving them tools to help them manage the contract. Because besides the training, if they don't have that information, it's very difficult for them to administer those contracts.
Representative Henson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that I think the figure was you'd recovered $99 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Henson, that's correct. And that was in the last fiscal year, 2003-04.
Okay. Is that actual recovery of $99 million, or is that determining that there was, like, overpayments and stuff reaching that amount that we're trying to collect? Did you actually get it all back?
Chairman Richardson, Representative Henson, that's the amount that was actually collected.
Okay. Excellent.
Goes back to my original. I'll get that article for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes. With Healthy Start, I mean, do you do any kind of auditing or follow up with Healthy Start and their contract that they have, or is that strictly with the children? What is it called?
Mr.
Children,
Chairman.
Adults, and families.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ramona Sanderson. Yeah, that's those contracts are between Commission on Children and Families and the counties and stuff. So.
When we have these contracts, and I've had several that we've had through the DHS, they say cost per
unit, I think that's the term they use, has increased so much because staff is spending half of their time making sure they're collecting all of the data rather than actually providing the much needed services for the children, families, et cetera. Is there analysis, too, of the what costs for per unit service? Do you follow that at all?
Chair Richardson and Senator Mona Sanderson, it would vary depending on the type of the contract and probably the funding source and the type of service being provided. But that's a continual struggle that we always try to take into consideration, because if we're going to contract with someone and make the reporting requirements so onerous that they're going to spend their time gathering data instead of providing the service, then that's very problematic, and it's not a place we want to put a provider in. Unfortunately, in some cases, with federal money, some of the reporting requirements, we really don't have an option. We have to pass those federal reporting requirements on to the contractors.
And that Friday afternoon, Senator Bates and Representatives Esquivel and Buckley and myself were hearing in Central Point for Southern Oregon, and we received testimony from directors of the offices down there, and one very experienced individual indicated that Medicaid delivery service people are spending about 50% of their time doing paperwork. And was talking about how that compares like with OPI and others as far as the amount of time you can actually spend working with people, and then how much time you have to spend letting everybody know what you're doing. And it's a kind of a tar baby. You know, or it's a difficult time because you have to comply, but your goal really is to help. So it's a real complex.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, also, you know, one of the areas that we're looking at in process improvement is the whole contracting area. It really hit home with me when I did a contract with a private contractor for $5,000, and the contract was 30 pages. The statement of work was one paragraph. So we definitely have a problem in some of the paperwork areas, and we are looking at that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to comment on that there is a significant difference between the paperwork on OPI and federally funded. OPI is a general fund only program. Anything that's federally funded, we're going to follow the federal law on how we, you know, follow up on all the record keeping and so on like that. So there are some real significant differences. The people who testified before you were correct. I need to amend something I said to Senator Mona Sanderson. Cindy Shike reminded me that a year ago, the commission, the local commission of Marion County, asked us for some help to review Healthy Start here in Marion County, and we did agree to lend them some auditors to help them look at that. So I want to make sure I was not incorrect. And generally, we don't audit it, but you know, we try to be supportive of the commissions when they ask for help. And in this case, we were able to give them some audit support and looking at Healthy Start here in Marion County only.
Mr. Chair, a public health nurse is a community public health nurse that actually is in field services. When you're in the rural area, you're doing real well if you can see two patients a day. And half of that time, when I was working in Multnomah County, I could see maybe 4 to 5 patients a day. And because of the and that doesn't seem maybe cost effective when you have to spend so much time on the paperwork. But if you see 4 or 5 in the day, it may take in one day, it may take you 2 days to make sure you get all of the paperwork done.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters,
in doing the forms review and that you take into consideration both the federal mandates or what federal required for reporting. Also, it would be interesting to know how much of the information that is required comes from this body. You know, we tend to also have a lot of requests on things that we want, and I think in order to put all this in perspective, we cannot just talk about what is wanted, what the feds demand, but also what this legislative body request as well. I think it might be an eye opener to some individuals to learn that we ask for quite a bit.
You know, I also mentioned that in this committee, we need to be careful with some of the things we request, because it's easy to give out a two-sentence request that can cost hours and hours of work. And so it's certainly, you're right, we have to be careful.
And Mr. Chad, I would also add that probably the third or fourth group is the Department of Justice, and all of the various rules and requirements and protections that the Attorney General would like us to have in our contracts and other pieces of enforcement. So balancing the risk versus protection and all of that.
Yeah.
Okay, if I can continue and talk about the Office of Public Affairs. We have eight individuals in the Office of Public Affairs, and they are responsible. Again, this is also a shared service. Each of the former divisions, now clusters, used to have their own complement of individuals who did public affairs for them, and we consolidated that into the office. That includes internal and external communications, media relations, legislative affairs, web content development, outreach services, and really publications, other documents and contacts for the entire agency. The office itself is within the budget cluster of administrative services, but the administrator of the Office of Public Affairs reports directly to Gary and I. We have a similar relationship, and you'll hear about that tomorrow with Bill Crowell and the Chief Information Officer. The OIS, Office of Information Services, is within administrative services from a budget perspective, from a policy perspective, and vision perspective that CIO reports to Gary and I. So we've got the budget, and then we have the reporting relationship, which in a couple of instances are different. That's more of a matrix management where Clyde oversees the coordinates the budget and personnel and operations of those offices, but the heads of those offices report to us. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions? Great.
No.
Okay. To continue, Office of Facilities on page 13 of the handout, and this office is responsible for managing the 165 offices we have throughout the state. This includes the Human Services Building in Salem and the Portland State Office Building. And a list of the services they deliver is on pages 13 and 14. This office works in conjunction with the Department of Administrative Services and our program offices to determine the best approach to combining offices or services as existing leases expire. They develop cost-effective strategies and solutions to design buildings that are accessible to both clients and the general public. They're also responsible for coordinating the telecommunications systems that our offices use. They work with vendors and our program staff to determine the most efficient and cost-effective telephone systems for our local office buildings. Moving on to the Office of Human Resources on page 14. This office is responsible for all the personnel-related functions in the department. This includes labor relations, recruitment and retention of staff, training, compensation and classification, affirmative action, safety and health, and that includes the management of our workers' compensation claims.
Senator Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go back to telecommunications real quick?
Sure.
That's been an issue, I know, in trying to coordinate our electronic reporting system within DHS.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind, I know within the human services, they've worked with WIC and well child or immunizations. Mm-hmm. What about communicable disease, CD, et cetera? Are we all in environmental services? Are they all starting to look at integrating their systems?
Chairman Richardson and Senator Monis Anderson, we are working very closely with all of the public health offices in the area of telecommunications. I think one of the we don't have as many issues in the area of telecommunications as we do in data, and the data issues are handled through data. OIS and Bill Crowell's shop, and part of the struggle we have around data are some of the requirements that the federal grants that the public health relies on have around data and how we gather, collect, and in some cases even the kinds of systems that the federal government wants us to use, which may not necessarily be compatible with the department's data systems, but may be compatible with federal or a consortium of states' data systems. And I think when Bill comes up and makes his presentation, he can speak a little more about some of the issues we have around coordinating data systems within public health.
But Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, around the telecommunications, to give you an idea of, I think, how much progress we've made, when we started here in the public service building, or the Portland City Office building in Portland, there were like 17 or 18 telephone systems in that building, because anytime anybody came into the building new, they got their own telephone systems. And one of the things that we actually started this, I guess, when we were at DAS, when someone came in new, and the first time I said, no, there's not going to be another telephone system. You have to hook up to somebody. It was a major crisis. Our goal, which we've worked on and made a lot of progress, is to collapse all of those. And this is really a DAS initiative more than it is a DHS, but all of those telephone systems in the Portland State Office building into a single one. There's no reason why we should run a state building with multiple telephone systems. It's extraordinarily expensive and doesn't serve for real good communication. So I mean, I don't know if that's on point for what you wanted, what your question was, the basis for your question, but I think it's important to know that we're constantly looking at things like that as a way to be more efficient and to economize on the resources that we have. So,
Mr. Chair, I think one of the other benefits we have with centralizing telecommunications, we are now able to actually share or pass along telecommunications systems from office to office. For instance, if we have an office that, because of staffing increases, has outgrown its telecommunications system, we may purchase a new one for that office. But then we can take that telecommunications system and put them in another office instead of having to buy a separate telecommunications system for an office that's kind of outgrown their system. So we do a lot of sharing of equipment and moving equipment around to meet the needs of the various branch offices in lieu of purchasing new telecommunications equipment.
Okay.
Getting back to the Office of Human Resources, this office is also responsible for the criminal record check function within the department. And each month, this unit conducts over 15,000 criminal record checks on DHS employees, providers, and volunteers. And this is a critical piece, and in fact is our first line of defense in screening out people who could pose a threat to the clients we serve. And it's a very difficult job, and they do a very good job out there, but it's a difficult task on a day-to-day basis.
I think what's interesting about this, of 15,000 a month, only 300 of these are our own employees, department employees. 5% or so, are LEDS law enforcement data system screenings that are done on behalf of our providers and county government and other local governments.
Okay. President Henson.
Okay. Is it a practice to, every time an employee is promoted, to do a fingerprint check and another records check?
Chairman Richardson and Representative Henson, for employees, the criminal record check process is kind of related to the type of function or the type of job they're performing. So if we had an employee who was, let's say, a clerical person in one office and kind of promoting to another clerical position in another office, similar or even a step above, if we had checked that person, we wouldn't necessarily check that person again. However, if the person was promoting, and this is the best example I can think of, it may not be the best example, but from a position where they're not working unsupervised with children into a position where they're working unsupervised with children, then we would go ahead and perform another check on that person.
What about fingerprint checks? How often?
Chairman Richardson and Representative Hansen, my understanding is that we run the LEDS check that Gary spoke of, if we have a hit there that says multi-state offender, and we actually will get that on LEDS checks, or if the person has not lived in the state of Oregon for the last 5 years, then we would run a fingerprint check automatically. Is that
right? Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, fingerprint checks are very expensive and they take more time, and we want to do them when we think there's some evidence that there's more here than what we can see on our local, because the LEDS only law enforcement data system only covers what's in our state law enforcement database and everything. Mm-hmm. And as Clyde said, we can get a hit that says multiple state offender, which then tells us now we've got to go FBI records, fingerprint check, and we.
Maybe I'm asking the wrong question. Whether mm-hmm. a fingerprint check or just fingerprinting, I know of a couple occasions where DHS employees, after receiving a promotion, mm-hmm. had to go to a processing center, be fingerprinted again, and I'm assuming also having a.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's true. And actually, that's one of the things that we've been working on. We have this labor management committee that we're looking at things that we can do differently. One of the suggestions that was made was, if you have someone's fingerprints, why do they have to be fingerprinted within, you know, certain amount of time or within the same agency? And so we're actively looking at, once we have your fingerprints, to not make you be re-fingerprinted again.
Yeah. They don't seem to change much.
Unless you're filing them off, I don't think so. That's correct. So we are going to be re-looking at that whole process. And if we have your fingerprints on file, not making you have to go be printed again.
Okay. And I guess one of the things I wonder about is why on something like that you'd even have to look at it twice. Why? Why doesn't the director just issue a
directive?
Yeah.
I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. You mean to stop doing it?
Yeah.
That's a good question, and it may already have been done by now, but last I heard of it, that we were looking at it.
Wasn't done as of a couple weeks ago.
Okay, thank
and
you.
The director can and probably will issue
by 3 o'clock today.
Issue that. These things come up, as Cindy said, I think it's one of the values of the fact that we have a real good, active, employee management group, you know, because these things surface to us and gives us a chance to respond to them. But, I mean, you could ask this question more broadly. I was fingerprinted at the lottery, at DAS, at DHS, and at the Department of Insurance and Finance. So I've got four sets of fingerprints floating around there somewhere. And I think we probably should ask the question more broadly. If we fingerprinted somebody in state government for any position, do we need to keep fingerprinting them when they even move outside of agencies? So,
well, he'll take care of it.
We will, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen. Okay. That's an easy one.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
That was my question, was why, you know, if you already have it on file, it would be, mm-hmm. do you have to do it, and it doesn't take legislation to get it removed. I mean, it just takes, but we will discontinue this practice, and you know, it sounds like systems overload.
Yeah. It is.
Or procedures that have been reviewed.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So you know what?
Right.
You have to change this.
Okay. Thank you for raising that.
Isn't there a cost to this? What's the cost? I mean, the cost of the individual. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, there's some cost. I mean, we have a staff person who's familiar with it. They have the ink pad and the mm-hmm. and the cards, and you just roll your fingers over it, and it takes about 4 or 5 minutes probably to do it. And
that's also the time.
But there's a time, and there's a storage on it.
Somebody's got to look at it. Mm-hmm. And then
right,
yeah,
correct.
So all that is
all the handling of the
cost.
Paper. Correct.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Okay. Do you need to continue?
Please continue.
Okay. The next office is the Office of Forms and Document Management, which starts on page 16. And I know Senator Winters has a particular interest in this area.
You leaped over affirmative action and... Safety, health, and employees assistance program.
We have, as a department, under Gary's leadership, worked very hard in the area of affirmative action. And I think while we still have a lot of work to do, I would say that we have... are one of the leaders in state government in terms of hiring people of color and people with disabilities. We're at or close to parity in a lot of areas within the department. We have a very active diversity development leadership council, which works closely with Peggy Ross in her office. And they actually, for the first time in the history of the department, have developed a strategic plan based on outcomes and performance measures that they have been implementing over the course of the last year. And this was done with Gary's encouragement and support, as well as the support of the cabinet of the department. And I know this is an issue that's very near and dear to Gary's heart, so I'd like to give him an opportunity to share.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I think we've tried to be very aggressive, and we'll continue to do so, to recruit folks. And Clyde's right. We have the most diverse agency in government, but we should have. The population we deal with is Oregon's population. We deal with a large Latino population, a large African American population, a Native American population. We should be the most diverse agency that you have in state government, and we're going to continue to work on that. Ironically, this morning, right before I walked over here, I signed a letter that's going out to all managers throughout our system to remind them once again of our goals on hiring a diverse workforce, educating and promoting and retaining a diverse workforce, and it's just a part of what I believe we have to do a good job within this agency and what we have to do within state government.
He's looking at me because I have quite a conversation with the governor's office on this issue, but all three of the senators do. And I'll ask you the same question that I asked public safety. And that is, what are the barriers or the obstacles that are in place that prevent you from getting diversity? You know, I go back a long way where your agency has had people of color and what have you heading up business and what have you. So I want to know what the barriers are. I asked this of Menace. Of Director Menace, you know, who is now training the director for DPSST. So I'm going to ask you the same question, because what we continually to get is that we're trying, we're recruiting, we're aggressively doing XYZ, and so it says to me that if something isn't occurring in the 6-7 years I've been back in this building, then that tells me there must be some barriers or some obstacles or something out there that is preventing agencies like yours and corrections of being able to fill positions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I don't think there are any barriers that are obvious. I think the challenge here is to make it clear that you have agencies that want to have a diverse workforce, that will create a welcoming environment in their agency for people of color. People of color do not want to work in an agency that they perceive as not having a welcoming environment. And so I think that's one of the things that you've got to be able to do, is persuade people you have the right kind of environment. And secondly, that you have the right opportunities for promotion. It's not so much just going out and finding a division administrator as a person of color. You know, it's in my view, anyway. My view is that you need to go out and recruit a diverse workforce, and you have to have in place the kind of training and promotion and development opportunities that allows you to grow the kind of leadership that you want in the agency. And that means working with graduate schools where you can find people that are interested in this. It means working with civic organizations. It means spending time with the Urban League and with the tribes and so on, to try to identify people that you can bring into your organization and develop them into the next generation of leaders for your organization.
Gary, if that was the policy when I was first recruited to come down here to Salem from Portland, I would have never been here.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, I would say that if that was the policy,
yeah,
it wouldn't have been followed very well, because it's easy to track this kind of stuff. It's easy to see what kind of a commitment an agency has to bringing people of color in, and then how do they promote those people? How do they retain those people? The record is clear. I mean, you either have done it or you haven't. And I think this agency has done a lot to do that. And it's a position that I've taken in four different agencies over 30 years of working with minority communities throughout the state, and will continue to take that position as long as I'm in this agency. But you have to make a commitment that you can demonstrate is real, you know, that you're really going to give people of color and people with disabilities, because I don't think we ought to be on that.
For instance, I was talking over the weekend with an ex-DHS employee who moved to Florida, who's moved back. He's got a lot of experience. He's very well educated. He has a deformed hand, and it's not even his dominant hand. And he was just, you know, he says, I don't even mention this because I feel like I can be hired just because of my experience and ability, but I'm having a real hard time getting getting hired and those kinds of things. And I said, you know, I don't know anything about that, but give me your packet and I'll just look into it, just to make sure that hiring takes place on merit, you know. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I understand affirmative action, but it's also that's a positive. I want to make sure that there's no negative, that people are not being hired because of things that, you know, that make them different from the majority of applicants, and so it's a balance.
Well, it's very troubling because when I look at it, and I look at it from the standpoint of almost as though we've gone somehow in Oregon, when you talk about diversity and you talk about individuals in positions and what have you. And I raise that barrier question because, you know, often we hear that, you know, we don't have enough qualified pools of individuals. Well, if that's not the problem, what is the problem? If you've got individuals who are qualified, who can perform the task, and it's hard for me to reconcile myself that you had it in 59 and you had it in the 60s and now we're talking 2001 and we don't have. And so that's where I'm, you know, that's why I raised the question, is it the climate? Is it Oregon's climate? You know, because certainly if you go east and you go Midwest and you go, you know, other places, you know, you're not having the same kind of discussion. And I raised that because, you know, if there are barriers, then you want to remove them. You know, if we do have qualified individuals, then you want to make certain that they have an equal shot like anyone else.
Mm-hmm. 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 You know, in defense of the organization, statistics don't tell full story. I mean, if there are individuals that are obviously qualified but are not getting hired, then, you know, we need to look at that, and I'm sure the department wants to look at it as well. Mm-hmm. If the department doesn't have them on the staff and can show that there is an outreach, that they're looking for qualified people, it's not incumbent on the department to search other states, I don't believe. I think that it's about hiring qualified people, with making sure that those that are in minorities have an opportunity to be, certainly to
we do. We do search other states for positions, you know, not just for minorities or whatever. We do search when we're looking for something specifically in government outstate. So that's not anything that's unusual. For Oregon or any other state, for that matter, when you're looking for professionals, qualified professionals.
Of course, if you're looking for people on a search based on qualifications and experience, that's one thing. But are you saying that you really believe that the state ought to be going over the country?
No, that is not what I said. What I'm saying is that the culture and the climate today, you know, and I asked the question, the same question I asked of public safety, what is going on in our state or in this climate that poses the question of why haven't we individuals when we talk about diversity? Is it lack of qualification? You know, what really is taking place in Oregon?
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, let me just talk about, we just did a recruitment for a public health director. I created this position. I've talked with you about trying to restore public health. We did a national search. I mean, we went to colleges and universities and medical associations, public health groups, and so on. And in all of that search, we generated one person of color as an applicant. Now, in part of that, I think, and I may be wrong, but I think as a field in public health, I don't think there are a lot of candidates today. There are up-and-comers. And this particular candidate, the one that was a person of color, was an interesting person, but... You know, we hired a woman out of Lancaster County in Virginia with a law degree, medical degree in pediatrics, and a master's in public health, who is probably one of the foremost public health people in this country. I'm very happy about it. Would I have liked to have had a person of color in that job? Of course I would have. But she was clearly the best qualified. We were very lucky to get her here to Oregon, but it wasn't for not trying. And I think your question is a good one. Is there something about what has changed in the state? I mean, I've done this for a long time, and it's very difficult to recruit people of color to live in Salem. Now, Senator, I think you understand this problem, and those people of color that are in leadership positions that you know from prior years didn't live here. They went to the Portland community, where there was a larger community, whether it was African American or Asian or Latino and so on. And I think it is a challenge for us to build a local community around the state capitol that enables us to bring people here, because I think we lose something when people come in to work in this government but then go to live somewhere else. I think we lose an opportunity. So, I mean, that's just an editorial comment. But
Mr. Chair, Senator,
you can do with it what you want. So.
Now, having grown up back east and spent a lot of time in the Midwest, Oregon is different. Oregon looks different. When we go to regional or national meetings, the color of Oregon is different. That doesn't make it right, but I think it makes it more challenging because people who of color, as Gary said, aren't dying to come down to an agency or a state government that is so white. It is a challenge for them, and what you see happening in government is that people, agencies steal from each other. So you see people of color who are going from agency to agency, and it's been, you know, as agencies, because they know these individuals. And so we just had our the head of recruitment for our agency, wonderful, bright woman, Sherry Tebow Harrell, is now going to Employment Department. And by the way, we got her from DCBS. And so what you see happening is that people of color are stolen.
Rockland.
Huh?
Near Rockland.
We recruited to run training and education for DAS.
Right, the woman that we recruited, right, who ran training and education for DAS, was hired by the private sector. African-American woman, incredibly talented, was just hired by the private sector, making a whole lot more money. These aren't excuses. We can do a better job, and we're going to continue to do that.
No, I don't want to belabor it, but I do want to ask the question, because the response constant on every one that I receive on affirmative action, this is what we're getting back on budget committees. And the question becomes, are there barriers or are there problems that you've identified? You know, part of it, I know that it's very difficult to get anybody to come to Oregon because we don't have a large population. You know, That's one issue. You know, and there could be others. So I'm asking you, as you're out there doing your job and your work, you know, have you seen or perceived issues? You know, the same as I asked John. And John talked about the culture inside of the police department, for example. That's a huge issue for him and to work on when you start talking about the ability to recruit and get individuals to be a part of that particular discipline.
Okay, now they've given three answers.
Yeah.
One is, depending on the requirements, it's difficult to find, you know, people that want to come to Oregon that are of color. Second is that when they do make a good recruitment, there's other departments and organizations in and out of the private public sector that want, you know, that will steal them away. And the other is that the living conditions and environment and neighborhoods and so forth here make it more attractive to be in Portland than down here. Have they answered the question, or do you want additional?
I don't want to belabor it, because I also know that we've got to address it as a state, because as our population continues to be diverse, particularly Latino and whatever, we've got to be able to find some answers and to this particular issue. Senator Gurley and I have both worked very hard on cultural competency, you know, to try to address it through that avenue, through our universities and those systems. But it's one that as our quilt becomes diverse, we're going to have to, in the future, begin to address this particular issue in the state of Oregon.
Okay, one thing that Director Weeks has mentioned that I think that needs to be followed up on is the idea of coordinating with education systems and so forth. See, I have a little hesitation. I am not concerned about trying to make sure that people in other states have jobs here. You know, I want to make sure that, if at all possible, that Oregonians have jobs. And so I would think that if there's something that we can do to help promote going into neighborhoods and into high schools and talking with counselors and teachers as to people that might have the opportunity and the ability and interest to be developed for positions, and help get counseling and mentoring and work through community college and universities or whatever to help bring people along, so that we're actually kind of being a patron or a mentor to people, you know, to people of color who may have opportunities that they don't even know about if they were to take a path in education.
Well, you're just reinforcing my point. I want to see the child, the young person who graduates, stay in Oregon. And currently, they don't.
Right.
Currently, they go someplace else other than remaining here at home. And so that's why I'm asking these questions. How do we get them to feel as comfortable about their state that they would remain in their state and not go to Southern California, or not going to Washington, which is or not going to the East, to New York? And I think it does begs itself for conversation of what's occurring in our state. How can we keep these young people here that are qualified?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's going to go far beyond DHS, but it's something that we can look at.
Right. Support them.
Moving along.
To finish up the Office of Human Resources, on page 16, we have our Safety and Health Unit, and this is a group that, among other things, manages our workers' compensation claims, does the early return to work, and also helps employees access the Employee Assistance Program. And this is the one area where we feel that we need to make a concerted effort to hold those costs down and to prevent accidents, and is really one area where we can generate savings for the department. We also have the Training and Development Unit. It provides centralized leadership for the department's training functions, focuses pretty intensely on management training, which we think is critical, especially during times when you are going through workforce reductions. You really need top-level managers to kind of keep morale up and make sure that the work's getting done. And then we also handle labor relations management.
Okay,
which,
that may interrupt next question.
Sure.
I'm wondering if your department, when you're talking about workers' comp issues and those kinds of things, if you're involved with Agency with Choice and first of all, do you know if you could tell us what Agency with Choice is and where we're at as far as that issue is concerned? It's coming up now.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're referring to seniors and people with disability. We have a workforce of about 13,000 home care workers, and they were given by a vote of the people in a constitutional amendment the right to organize.
Right.
And there was created a home care workers commission, and the first contract was bargained the last session, and I was responsible for that because I was director of DAS at that time. That contract has been difficult to administer because of workers' comp costs, and it's nothing to say about the union. You know, it's not a judgment about the union. It's about how you are able to manage the cost of workers' compensation in a work environment where you have 13,000 people all working in homes of clients. And so the normal things that you do to manage your workers' comp claims are to provide training, worksite inspections, improvements in the worksite. Those things are very difficult to do in this environment. And we knew when we first bargained that contract, Mr. Chairman, that the workers' comp compensation costs could be higher. But we needed to have workers' comp in order to get a health policy, because we were trying to bargain for health care. No health insurer is going to provide you with policy without a backup workers' comp. And so we bargained it that way, and indeed the costs have been considerable. And so what you refer to is a proposal that we're bringing forward for your consideration to actually have the state. It does a couple of things. One is the state would not be the managing agent for this contract. We would hire an independent organization to manage the contract with the workers. But secondly, and probably most importantly and most difficult for the discussion, is that the client's choice, because under the current procedures now, the client chooses who they want their caregiver to be. In our proposal, the client's choice would be limited in the sense that whomever they may choose would have to meet the requirements of the job. And that's not true now. We have people that are well into their 70s acting as caregivers, and they themselves being exposed to some risks of injuries. And that's our problem right now. And so the client with choice would mean the client still has choice, but the choice is from among workers who are capable of doing the job in the home. And that's a big change, and it will cause a lot of debate for you. And I can tell you, I mean, honestly, we're talking to the union about this. They would prefer not to have that happen. But we cannot control the costs if we have workers who are not able to meet the test of the job. They're not able to move someone, lift someone,
right,
do the kinds of things that you have to do in a home to take care of a disabled or an elderly person. So
that helps.
But we'll have a lot of opportunity, I'm sure, to talk to you more about this, Mr. Chairman. So.
Thank you.
Okay. The next office is the Office of Forms and Document Management on page 16. And this office provides services in the area of document management, forms development, distribution, and archiving. This includes assisting department staff with forms development, printing and distribution, language translation, and alternate formats like Braille. This office is also responsible for processing Medicaid provider claims. The unit enters and processes an average of 103,000 claims a month from dentists, doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, and other Medicaid providers. This office is also taking a lead role in converting some of our hard copy paper processes to an electronic document management process. This unit already electronically images more than 500,000 pages of documents each month, and we believe that converting from a hard copy paper process to an electronic process will increase staff productivity, save storage space, and allow us to process more applications with less staff. And our final office is the Office of Information Security. This was an office we established in April of 2004, and they're responsible for improving the department's infrastructure around information security, as well as implementation of the Security Act of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, as it's more commonly known. The HIPAA security rule requires us to adhere to HIPAA standards when creating, processing, transmitting, and storing electronic protected health information. And we have to be in compliance with the HIPAA security rule by April of 2005. And at this point, we anticipate that we will be able to meet that deadline. We're on schedule to meet that April deadline. The second initiative, main initiative in this office is around business continuity planning. And this is a big need, not just in DHS, but also in the state. And this is the process of developing plans and procedures to enable us to continue to provide services in the event of an emergency, such as an earthquake, a fire, a flood, or any of those types of things where an office's ability to operate may be impacted. And the last initiative that I want to talk to you about in this office is around access control and authorization. This is an area that in a past Secretary of State audit we came under quite a bit of fire for. And since that time, we've established the Information Security Office, and they're in the process of developing an access control model that will allow us to control access to all of our systems. And this will also help us to meet the HIPAA requirement that people only get access to the information they need to do their job and not to the, to the whole universe of DHS information.
Okay.
And that concludes my testimony. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Timing is excellent. Appreciate the great information and all the good work you're doing. It's a huge challenge that your department has.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, we'll be adjourned.
Thank you.